Welcome to Talking Global Infrastructure, brought to you by the Global Infrastructure Investor Association. Now more than ever, governments around the world are recognizing the importance of partnership with the private sector to deliver the transformational investment required to meet global challenges. But how do we deliver the enormous scale of investment needed to close the infrastructure gap in an affordable way, whilst addressing societal challenges such as net zero commitments, climate resilience, and the digital economy? GIIA and its members are at the forefront of this debate, and Talking Global Infrastructure is the podcast that will delve into these subjects and more to bring you valuable insights from the experts in the sector. Hello, I'm John Phillips, Acting Chief Exec at the Global Infrastructure Investor Association, and I'm delighted to be joined by Andrew Jones, Conservative MP for Harrogate and Knaresborough, and Chair of the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Infrastructure. For the eighth episode in our podcast series, we're going to be discussing the current infrastructure climate in the UK, and as the parties start to think about their manifestos for the next election, we want to explore the kinds of issues that we believe they should be thinking about when they are considering their manifesto development. Hi, Andrew, and thank you for taking time to join us today, and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much. Good morning to you, John, and thanks for the opportunity to join you today as well.
So to start us off, Andrew, can you explain for our audience what the APPG is, how it works, and what you're currently focused on?
Absolutely. Well, we are one of a number of all-party groups. They're a quite popular part of parliamentary life, but not everybody knows what they are. Basically, they are groups that bring people together from all parties, from the Lords and from the Commons, to discuss a political issue or just to highlight or bring awareness to an issue. There are probably at least 800 of them or so within Parliament. I chair the All-Party Group for Infrastructure. We're one of the most active groups in Parliament, and I'm afraid I think that comes down to who's basically providing energy, and I think this is a moment of huge interest in infrastructure right across the House, so I think that's why we are achieving such a high profile. Our role really is to highlight the role of infrastructure in the UK economy, and especially its role, actually, by the role infrastructure can play in solving key government problems. But also, the more we're talking about it, we're creating, I hope, more of a space, a dialogue for encouraging longer-term decision-making. We've had a problem, I think, in the UK where we haven't really been taking the long-term decisions that we need to. We have underinvested in infrastructure over many decades. That applies to governments of all colours. We need now to catch up, but we also need to understand why people haven't invested in the longer term in government. And I think it's because the length of time it can take to deliver infrastructure. So we're now looking at encouraging longer term decision making. You also asked, John, what we're up to at the moment. Well, that actually is our current focus. It's about getting that space for dialogue and long term decisions. A good example, actually, of where we bring people together both in Parliament and also with the industry is a paper we published only a few months ago, and that was looking at how we can take some of the cost out and put more speed into delivering rail infrastructure. So it's basically full of practical things that we can do to make the infrastructure investment an easier long-term decision for British governments.
I see. And of course, one of the big policy challenges facing government is around net zero and the kind of investments that are going to be necessary as we transition energy requirements and delivery towards net zero. Last month saw the publication of a very important document called Mission Zero, a collection of findings from an independent review of net zero policy led by Chris Skidmore. The paper makes a number of recommendations and actually calls for 25 key actions by 2025. Two of those actions were particularly notable from my point of view, and that was the creation of a new forum to coordinate across regulators and also for Treasury to review how policy incentivizes investment in decarbonisation. I was interested to get your take on how the paper's conclusions have been received in Westminster and the sort of conversations that this has stimulated in your group.
Right. Well, I think overall this has landed well. I think that Chris's paper is seen as further progress on an already established journey. We have the net zero objective in law now. So the question isn't so much why as how. And I think actually in some ways it's been slightly overshadowed by other events, both politically here and globally. But there were, in essence, I think four themes to that paper. Incentives for business to decarbonise, reforms in things like planning process to put decarbonisation at the centre of the planning process in local government, energy efficient homes, which is certainly an issue that chimed with me because that, I think, is an absolute no-brainer. And also, judging by the inbox that I and my colleagues received, is certainly an area of significant public concern. No surprise that, I would suggest, with the increase in energy prices. But then also, which I think will be really interesting from this group's perspective, how infrastructure can be used to unlock net zero with the requirement to develop a strategy to build and adapt new green energy sources, hydrogen and the like. So I thought there were some good practical points in that Mission Zero paper from Chris Skidmore, and I think that it's now a question of getting on with the activity. I think it's landed well with government. And the points you make about the role of infrastructure, I view those are absolutely fundamental to making progress. So I was pleased to see that reinforced by the Skidmore review.
There's much talk about hydrogen as being a really important part of our energy mix going forward and its role in helping to deliver net zero ambitions. What do you see as the role for hydrogen and what needs to be done to turn lots of conversations into some actual concrete activity?
Well, I think hydrogen is really exciting. I think it is a prospect that in some ways everybody has jumped on, but we need to actually work out this is not as straightforward. You can't just switch from one to the other. The energy density between gas and hydrogen isn't the same to start with. So there are huge consequences. But the biggest challenge that we face, I think, with net zero is the 45 million or so homes in the United Kingdom that are powered by natural gas boilers. So it's going to be I think hydrogen is going to play a major role as we decarbonise that sector. But let's take a pace back. Is hydrogen going to be a part of the future? Definitely. Will other new green technologies come into play, such as battery farms? Absolutely. I think it's very exciting. I cut the ribbon years ago on a hydrogen fueling station down at the National Physical Laboratory in Bushey Park. And I think it just shows that people have been thinking about hydrogen for a little while now. I can see it playing a major role in things like transport. Not perhaps the everyday car, the cars that you and I may drive, which I think will probably go electric, but in things like HGVs or in the rail industry. I look at other technologies such as battery farms and think this is brilliant. We're going to be able to capture energy generated perhaps offshore in renewables when there isn't much demand. We can store that and feed it back into the grid when the demand is there. So I think that hydrogen brings, and other battery farms, they bring with them resilience. They bring net zero, power when we need it. We need to make sure that as we move into much more of a hydrogen economy, the hydrogen that we're using is green hydrogen. Otherwise, we will be in danger of not achieving the maximum benefits of this. So because we have green hydrogen, blue hydrogen, grey hydrogen, at the heart of this is a fuel which can be absolutely critical to the future, but it's not consequence-free in the changeover.
When we think about the various opportunities for investment in infrastructure, be that in new technologies like hydrogen or battery storage and electric vehicle charging or more traditional infrastructure, one of the key issues for us, of course, is the extent to which countries' governments are thinking about how to make themselves attractive to international investors. So one of the things that we do is undertake a temperature test of investor sentiment every few months or so in what we call our Pulse survey, which we produce in partnership with one of our member companies, Alvarez & Marsal. The next edition of this is due out in a few months' time. And it's a fascinating time, I think, to look at what is clearly a competitive situation developing, even more so than ever, I think, for that international capital. We see the US bringing forward policies such as the Inflation Reduction Act and the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. We see the European Union stimulating investment in green technologies through the Green Deal Industrial Plan that they are now talking very positively about. What do you think needs to be done in the UK for the UK to retain its place as a primary investment destination? Are we in danger of getting left behind?
I hope not, and I don't think so. I think when it comes to investment decisions, I think there are lots of different criteria within it. Economic stability, financial incentives, the regulatory framework, the ease of doing business in a country, the skill set of the workforce. I think all these contribute to making sure that the UK will be an attractive investment destination. And I hope we don't get into the point where we're just going to have a debate simply about who's got the biggest financial incentive, the subsidies, because I think actually that will miss the key points about regulatory framework, easy doing business and skills, where the UK is very strong. So I think the kernel of this is how is the UK competitive? We need to measure ourselves about global competitiveness league tables. We need to be near the top of those. And I'm aware, obviously, of the incentives that you mentioned, John, but I think it's a part of the mix and an important part of the mix, but it's not all of the mix. When I certainly was making decisions, which I fully agree were not in this sector, but when I was making investment decisions running businesses before coming into Parliament, I was looking at the maximum stability for the decisions. So I'm effectively minimising risk from my decision making. And I think that is an area where the UK can be very strong. Financial incentives will play a role. We have to also mention, I think at this moment, that we've got energy levies taking place pretty much across the world because we've seen such changes in the prices of energy. Obviously, you've seen the UK levy, which is effectively 45% level on actual revenues achieved above a certain benchmark price. We don't yet know where the energy prices will stabilise, or indeed if they will stabilise, which I have to say I think they will. But we are seeing people get unplanned for and unbudgeted profits as a direct consequence of global price changes following the Ukraine war. I think we have to recognise that it's reasonable, I think, to have some windfall intervention from a government perspective when there's so much support being provided for energy users. But we mustn't get that balance wrong so that we deter investment. So I think there is quite an interesting balance to be struck here. We've got to get that right. The way to do that, I think, is to make sure that there is significant dialogue between the industry, that's those doing the investing, those financing the investing, and government and regulators. I think dialogue is absolutely critical here. That's a slightly separate question, the energy levy, slightly separate question to the one you talked about in terms of the investment destination. But I think it is a very live part of the framework we have at the moment caused by the Ukraine war and all of the challenges that we've got from it. But the kernel of good investment destination decisions are economic stability, legal stability, financial stability, incentives certainly, the regulatory framework, the ease of doing business and the skill set of the population and in the workforce. So all of those are, I think, are critical factors in this, I think, very, very live discussion.
I'm glad you raised the generator levy. I think it's an interesting area of policy. And I tend to agree with you that it's not unreasonable in principle for these unplanned profits to be recycled into helping in the short term some of the cost of living issues that the country is facing. But one thing I am puzzled by and I think is represents a little bit of muddled policy thinking is that in the context of oil and gas generators, the scheme that the windfall tax that was brought in actually provides for incentives for reinvestment in renewables, whereas the generator levy on renewable energy profits does not provide similar tax incentives for reinvestment. So we sort of have a situation where those who are investing and operating in fossil fuels are being incentivized through tax breaks to reinvest, and those who are already investing in renewable energies are not. This seems to me to be a bit of muddled thinking and something that we are keen to try and drive a conversation with government on. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yes, I do indeed. We need to have more renewables. Renewables is the right answer because of their resilience, because of their decarbonisation. And the key, therefore, is to make sure that we have a taxation and regulatory framework which incentivises investment in all sectors. And that is reasonable. Getting complete parity across the different sectors may not be very easy because, quite frankly, they have different dynamics. And I think probably disconnecting the dynamics, because at the moment the electricity price is often set by the price of gas. Well, the price of gas has just been changed by Mr. Putin's invasion of the Ukraine. Having that evil act influence the price that we're paying in electricity for the wind farms in the North Sea seems to me completely ridiculous. So we need to disconnect the various things. But if we don't have a platform which encourages investment in all sectors, we will be getting it wrong. All sectors are required, and we need to invest our way out of this difficulty, and we need to encourage this to happen quickly. So if there are going to be problems which are disincentivizing that investment, we need to highlight it and correct it.
I quite agree with you on that. The government, of course, has a number of levers at its disposal to try and stimulate investment. We've touched on the regulatory framework and potentially the tax environment. But there's also the UK Infrastructure Bank, particularly, as one of those tools in the toolbox, so to speak. Where do you think the UK Infrastructure Bank is best placed to play a role in bolstering investment in infrastructure?
Well, I think it's still early days, of course, for the bank, but I have to say I've been encouraged by it. I'm encouraged by it actually existing. That's the key thing, because I think it just places infrastructure right at the heart of policy. I think the main area where they're going to come together, actually, is bringing the different groups, like a convening power, I suppose, for both the public and private finance. This is something that we haven't done that well in the UK for a little while. You know, we've had public-private partnerships, the Private Finance Initiative, PFI2. I have to confess here, John, I was responsible for starting the PFI review as a Treasury Minister because I looked at this and I thought to myself, this is proving very expensive, highly inflexible. Is this really delivering what we need? It wasn't from the point of view of the principle being wrong, because quite frankly, it isn't. You know, I'm somebody who's come from a robust private sector background, sees the future as a very healthy private sector driven economy, creating the wealth and the opportunities that we need, and also, of course, the innovations that we need. So the question is how to bring the two together. The mechanism was clunky, expensive. We'd actually had to buy some contracts out because they were just so inoperable. But that work to replace them hasn't really developed that well, I don't think, to be honest. And I would hope and expect the Treasury is working on this. because the principle of bringing capital from the public and private sectors together simply will be able to get more done more quickly if we can do that. So I think it is a mechanism issue, not a principle issue. And if it's only the mechanism issue, then we should be able to work it out.
Well, I sincerely hope you're right that Treasury is looking at this area, because whilst I don't take issue with you at all that perhaps the experience of the PFI and PFI2 model in the UK was not an unqualified success, the fact remains that many of the other countries that that we GIIA are engaged with around the world are all, many of them are using the PPP model to great effect and really working well with the private sector to, I think, achieve much more in terms of infrastructure investment than the UK has been of over recent years. So if I look at Canada, Australia, the US, all economies that I think the UK should rightly be comparing itself with, the PPP model is thriving in those countries. So something went wrong in the UK, but I think I agree with you that the principle of the model, I think, is not the problem. Perhaps the execution of the model is where the UK could actually learn from other countries in terms of the way to operate this way and to achieve more infrastructure investment.
Well, I'm right up for learning from other people's examples. Quite frankly, we should all be doing that. It isn't easy doing stuff first. We see it all the time in different policy areas. Now, in the last few days in Parliament, we've been tackling the online harms bill, not in any way relevant to this particular discussion, but the point is it's the first in the world, pretty much, and consequently we're finding new ways through quite knotty problems, and the world is watching us with a view to looking and learning. Well, I'm very happy to do more looking and learning when it comes to ideas to bring in private finance, global investors into UK infrastructure. And I will pick this up as an output from our discussion today. I will actually make contact with Treasury Minister just to see what's going on and just to highlight the wisdom of looking around and making sure that the UK is open for business from a global infrastructure perspective.
Well, that's encouraging. Thank you. And I guess brings us quite neatly to perhaps the last question I have for you, which is with the next general election possibly not too far away, many pundits predicting a 2024 election at least. As we look towards the manifesto development and party conference season in the autumn, what do you see as the core infrastructure priorities from a policy point of view? And the APPG, what will it be calling for in it as these manifestos are developed?
Well, that's a very wide question. We haven't quite got as far as manifesto development work yet. It hasn't really started, though it is starting, though it hasn't really got going. That's within the party. I would anticipate the APPG certainly playing a role in that. Infrastructure is going to be a big part of the manifesto, I think, from probably every party. Infrastructure investment drives economic growth. It drives social progress. It drives decarbonisation. It drives levelling up. It drives the enhancement of skills within the workforce. All of these things are major problems. So infrastructure investment is going to be absolutely critical. No progress on that. No progress on net zero. No progress on levelling up, etc. So I think we can expect continued focus. So from the all-party group's perspective, I think it will be to ensure that infrastructure investment is maintained. But I'm also going to be trying to drive things a little bit more than, not just from a financial transaction, but also that we have the legacy of more skills and a UK-based supply chain. I think that resilience of supply chain in all sorts of areas of public policy, but especially in the world of energy, is going to be pretty critical. And that's not really been a feature for several decades now, really, but it will be because of global geopolitics, and increasing resilience urgently is necessary. You know, crikey, if you were the German government, in response to the Russian invasion of the Ukraine, you had to change your foreign policy, defence policy and energy policy, all within about 10 days. Having had a particular direction of travel for decades, you had to reverse all three major policy areas in about 10 days. That's the kind of change that we've got going on in global politics. And that's why resilience is going to be an increasing feature, I think, of investment. And I would expect that to be at the heart of the manifesto. So, in summarise that for you very quickly, investment to drive key policy objectives, but with a legacy of skills, a legacy of a domestic supply chain with a view to boosting resilience for the future. And if I don't mind, last sneaky point, if I could. Okay, thanks, John. We are very open for ideas. I'm most aware of the membership and who you are reaching and ideas on how we can achieve some of these policy things that we've been talking about, how to deliver more infrastructure quickly, how we can open the UK for business, making sure that we've got a financial mechanism that works for both public and private. If people have got ideas, feed them through to me. I'll happily have a good look and take them through and forward them on to all the right people in government. So the key thing is we are open for ideas.
Well, that's a really positive note to end our conversation on. And Andrew, thank you very much for sharing your time and your insights with us. We really appreciate it. It's as we have agreed, there is very little that's more important than infrastructure in terms of the policy conversations right now, in the way that it touches almost every aspect of people's lives. And so we've got to get this right. And of course, we want the UK to thrive and to remain an attractive place for infrastructure investment. So we look forward to working with you and your group over the coming months. And thank you very much again for your time today and for sharing your thoughts with us.
Well, thank you very much, John. Much enjoyed our conversation. I look forward to working with you and the group over the year ahead. I think it is going to be a very, very interesting and important time. We've had economic shocks. We've had two supposedly once-in-a-century events just 12 years apart, and that excludes the war in Ukraine. I'm talking about the 08 crash, then the pandemic. Now we have a major war in Europe. This is a fundamental change to some of the questions that we have to ask ourselves in public policy. And if huge, supposedly once-in-a-century events are going to come along quite quickly, what does that mean for our public finances? How do we work together to ensure that we are more resilient in tackling those financial questions, but also policy questions? So, yeah, big challenges ahead. That, of course, is why we do it.
Thank you, Andrew. That brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you for listening, and look out for our next episode coming soon. Thank you for listening to Talking Global Infrastructure. For more information about GIIA, please visit our website, giia.net, and look out for the next edition of our podcast by following us on LinkedIn and Twitter.